This is Focus 580, hour number two of our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be spending some time talking about joint pain. At some point in their lives, almost everyone will experience joint pain. It could be the result of a number of different things. Could be an injury. It could be something that you do by over-exercising, can be the result of aging. This morning, we'll be looking at some of the causes and treatment of joint pain. And our guest for the show is Dr. Joseph Aboud. He is Clinical Assistant Professor of Orthopedic Surgery at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine and is the co-author of a good resource. If you'd like to read about joint pain, find out more information, you might look for the book that he co-authored. The title of his book is No More Joint Pain, Accurate, Comprehensive, and Authoritative Information on the Causes, Prevention, and Treatment of Joint Pain. The book is published by the Yale University Press. I'm sure that you could find it in the bookstore or possibly in the library. And we'll talk a little bit about it and give folks an opportunity to call in and ask questions. What I want to mention, I think whenever we have physicians on the program, I try to remind people who are listening and calling that we can't do diagnosis over the phone. There are limits to what the doctor can tell you because he can't see you. We hope that people still will call with questions, and this is a good place to start. We can give you some basic information, and then you may need to go on, pursue that with your own physician or with somebody who can see you. So I don't want to discourage people from calling, just to make sure that people know that there are limits as to what we can do here on the program. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So any point here, if you have questions, you pick up the telephone and give us a call. Dr. Aboud, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
There are a lot of joints. I guess I really didn't know how many. It says here in the book that we have more than 100. So there are a lot of opportunities, various places around the body for there to be pain and injury and so forth. Is there anything, when you talk about joint pain, is there anything or a couple of things that really ties it all together that they have in common, given that the fact that they can really have different causes and also can occur at a lot of different places?
I mean, I think the things that tie it together are joint problems generally are painful, they limit our mobility, and they affect our quality of life. So I think as far as what the patient perceives as the problem on a day-to-day level, it's those symptoms. As far as objective findings you can find on studies or x-rays or MRIs, yes, there's different patterns based on either the etiology or the cause of the problem, as well as the severity of the problem and the joint that's involved. They have somewhat different characteristics of what you will see. But I think the biggest reason people pursue care for these problems is really pain. And then also function is a close, probably second, as far as quality of life goes.
Yeah. And I suppose that one way to break this down would be to break it down into those kinds of issues that are, say, they are the result of an injury or the result from overuse, something that with care, treatment, rest, probably will get better. And then there's that on one side, but on the other side, there are conditions that are chronic.
Right.
And that they're pretty much where what you're doing is you're managing pain. There may be various kinds of therapies that you can use, but it's not the kind of thing where if you take care of it and do certain things, then it's going to go away.
Right. I mean, by and large, the most common cause is wear and tear, osteoarthritic type changes that happen over your lifetime from use, genetics, body habitus. Then you have your other types of arthritis problems. Most common, people tend to have someone in their family afflicted by it is rheumatoid arthritis. These patients, unfortunately, have basically an autoimmune problem where their body tends to attack their own synovium and cartilage and cause joint destruction. These patients, unfortunately, don't respond quite as well to the old, rice, rest, ice, compression, elevation, and the wear and tear problem will go away. Mm-hmm. Those typically have a more chronic, slowly progressive dimension to them.
Yeah, it seems to me that the fundamental issue here, that's what it seems to me as a layperson at least, is that in all these cases, what you've got is you have two bones that are coming together, and what you don't want is the bone itself rubbing up against itself or the neighboring bone. So there's a mechanism of cushioning that provides flexibility at the point where the two bones meet. And the issue, I guess, is that for a variety of reasons, this can deteriorate, it can wear out, and that's where you get your problem.
Exactly. The surface that we're talking about is the cartilage on the ends of each bone. And that cartilage is an amazing development that we as animals have. And that cartilage is key to preserving smooth, painless range of motion of the joint and really maintaining function into your 80s, 90s, or what be it. And as that cartilage starts to deteriorate, you start having, like you said, exposed bone, and exposed bone rubbing on another exposed bone causes pain. There's nerve endings there that causes sometimes bleeding in the joint, inflammation of the lining of the joint called the capsule. And as that happens, you start to lose motion because the next thing the patient does is when they're having pain, they avoid use. You avoid use, you get stiff, and you sometimes start developing atrophy of the muscles around there because, again, of disuse, and so perpetuates the problem.
So, to what extent is the tendency towards? I'm sure when it's much more clear when you're talking about rheumatoid arthritis, but even if you're talking about osteoarthritis, which is the most common, to what extent is genetics here important, and it's a kind of a predisposition that you see people inheriting from their parents?
As far as osteoarthritis goes, we know there is a strong genetic component. Now, it is definitely a multifactorial development, but there is a genetic component because we do see patients who come in, really have had no significant traumatic episodes in their lifetime, have never been a significant athlete, but they have those characteristic nodules on their fingers and arthritis throughout their body, and it hurts, but it's not characteristic of an inflammatory rheumatoid arthritis. It's more characteristic of an osteoarthritis. So there is a genetic predisposition. I think there's different severities of that, being mild, medium, and severe, and depending on the luck of your draw, essentially. If you have a mild form, then it's likely going to progress very slowly. If you have a mild form on top of it, you were a very robust individual, had lots of injuries during their athletic days, and maybe is overweight and adding more trauma to the joints, and then there's a propensity for that arthritis to progress faster. If you're unlucky enough to have a very strong genetic component, and maybe you are slim, never really had significant joint injuries, you still may develop fairly progressive significant arthritis despite no real cause of your own.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I'm sure that one of the questions that you're often asked is something like, is there anything that I could be doing through the course of my life that would, assuming that all other things are equal and I don't have a very strong tendency, an inherited tendency towards arthritis, is there something that I could be doing through the course of my life that would reduce the chances that it will develop, or maybe if there's some inevitability that's associated with aging, are there some things that I could be doing that would perhaps lessen the potential severity?
I think particularly when we talk about lower extremity problems, hips, knees, ankles, I think one of the biggest factors that a lot of times we as physicians have a hard time broaching with our patients is maintaining ideal body weight. The more weight you carry, the more stresses are imparted on the joint, whether it be with simple walking or running. So you're causing, with every cycle of that joint, you're causing some micro trauma to the joint. And just like a tire, cartilage wears out. So if you're constantly carrying around an extra 30, 40, 50 pounds of body weight, that's going to wear down the joint somewhat faster. The other thing is to maintain your conditioning. If you're going to be somebody who's going to go out and partake in a sport on a sort of a periodic basis or weekend warrior, so to speak, You want to make sure that you're maintaining your flexibility. You're keeping your muscles in good shape as far as the tone, because muscles really are shock absorbers around the joint. And the better condition they're in, the less likelihood that a traumatic episode during an activity would impart much damage to the joint. And flexibility is important because it decreases some of the what we call contact pressures between the two sides of a joint. So that way, not one area is constantly loaded, but the joint is symmetrically loaded. So those are things that people can do. And how do you do that? You know, you incorporate a simple stretching program into your exercise routine. I think when you're if you're one of those individuals that regularly exercises, you want to cross train, meaning doing some activities that are aerobic, some activities that are less weight bearing, such as exercising in a pool, some light weight training. I think one thing that unfortunately, society tends to do more than they probably should is heavy weightlifting, particularly in our younger males. And heavy weightlifting tends to, as you get older, be joint destructive. So the gentlemen you see in the gym who are bench pressing 350 pounds six times in their 20s, unfortunately, I'm seeing them in my office in the 40s with end-stage arthritis of their shoulders because really the shoulder wasn't designed to do that. And that, again, wears the cartilage down. So I think if you want to kind of take control of your joints and sort of not let fate be your sort of deciding factor, I think those are things you can simply do, which is, again, to summarize, keeping your ideal body weight, conditioning appropriately, cross-training, not doing too much of one thing. So if you're somebody who thinks that the elliptical is what they do and they do that, you know, 4 hours a week and that's all they do, I think that's probably too much of one thing. I think you need to cross-train, whether it be use the treadmill, go for walks, do some elliptical, do the stationary bike, swim, all those things can be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Joseph Aboud. He is clinical assistant professor of orthopedic surgery at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine and is the co-author of a book, No More Joint Pain, and it's published by the Yale University Press. So if that's an issue for you or someone who's close to you, you might want to take a look at the book. Questions are welcome here too, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. First caller up is in Champaign, and this is line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Actually, there's a couple points, but the first one that comes to mind, what about running? Isn't that hard on the ankle and stuff or not, or what happens there?
Obviously, running is a passionate pastime for many people in this country. And when you're running, I think the terrain is important. I think that running on concrete or cement can be tough on your knees. If you have access to either a track or a nearby university or high school that has a track or a softer surface such as AstroTurf or grass, I think that's easier on your joints. Now, that being said, there are numerous people that do run fairly regularly on tough surfaces and seem to have, at least patients I see, seem to have fairly well-preserved joints. They're in good shape. I think it has to do somewhat with the fact that they also tend to maintain ideal body weight, which tends to load their joint less so than other patients that tend to be more on the obese side.
Yeah, my cousin, excuse me, my cousin actually is an occupational thing, was a house builder, and certainly now he realizes that he's going to have the hip replacement on the right side. But, you know, he thinks about it, and, I mean, he was in really tremendous shape. But all that weight of carrying, and there was a tendency to carry it on the right hand, you know, the right side. Mm-hmm. You know, which, you know, just reinforces what you say in terms of it's like a weightlifting thing. Just that, and also the comment, the technology is really amazing in terms of hip replacement and now with the knee replacement. So if you want to maybe comment about that, and I'll hang up here.
Sure. Joint arthroplasty is a huge portion of what we do as orthopedic surgeons. In the right patient, it's miraculous what kind of improvement a patient can notice. And I think that the surfaces that we've been working on developing last longer, the surgeries have less risk to the patient, and the outcomes seem to be bearing out over generations. So, you know, joint arthroplasty is a very good treatment option for the appropriate patient. And typically, the appropriate patient has advanced arthritis of the joint. They've tried other ways of treatment, such as using an anti-inflammatory, physical therapy, and the role, when needed, of injections, whether they be lubricants versus cortisone. But when necessary, hip, knee, shoulder, elbow, ankle, those are all the disc, spinal disc, those are all being replaced at this point in this country. So it's an amazing technology, and it'll continue to increase as our population gets older and as our baby boomers hit their 60s and 70s.
All right, let's talk next with someone in Edgar County, line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask some questions about cortisone. I have a disintegration of the cartilage in my spine in the lower lumbar region. And also I have arthritis to a certain degree with calcium deposits and such. And they wanted to put me on a monthly injection of cortisone when I was only getting relief for a period after cortisone of about 10 days. What is your thinking on that?
Cortisone is not a benign drug. My personal bias is that cortisone is used in situations where patients have severe pain, they're not able to do their work, sleep, or perform any of their hobbies. And it can be used on a sparing basis. Typically, I don't recommend cortisone being done any more frequently than once every 3 months. And I think at some point after three, maximum four injections, you have to figure out what your endpoint is. Is your endpoint, if this is not giving you permanent relief, then I think you need to see somebody and get their opinion on what could give you permanent relief. Because repetitive cortisone can induce tissue damage, can induce diabetes, and, you know, repetitive injections can sometimes cause infection.
Well, that's what I found out from reading, as you stated, and my surgeon just said didn't matter, and so I have since ceased seeing them. What is your thinking regarding acupuncture?
Acupuncture at this point has become more mainstream than ever. Many insurance companies are picking it up as far as reimbursing for it through your insurance plan. There is data, particularly around the knee, to show that acupuncture can give relief as compared to placebo for patients who have arthritic joints. I think it's as long as you research who's doing it, who's performing it, they're certified, accredited. I would also recommend that you talk to several patients that have been treated by them and see what kind of experience they've had. But acupuncture is definitely a much more mainstream treatment than it was 20 years ago.
And do you think that it has any effects such as cortisone has?
I think both treatments, cortisone and acupuncture, work in a way that we don't fully understand in medicine. They somehow change your perception of pain, whether it be from the anti-inflammatory effect of cortisone or the way pain fibers in your body are perceiving pain and transmitting it to your brain. We're not sure, but they seem to both modulate your level of pain.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Information.
Next caller is line number 2, and this is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a couple questions. First of all, I wondered if you had ever heard of a condition called sacroiliitis.
Yes.
Okay. I had developed that during pregnancy a number of years ago, and it was severe. And I actually never really got much of an answer from my doctor at the time as to really what it was. I mean, it developed into such a severe condition that I ended up in a wheelchair, and it took me about 5 months. I finally did recovering and got over it, but I never really understood. I had severe pain in my, really in my hips, which kind of went down to my, you know, into my legs, and I wasn't able to walk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it happened at the end of my pregnancy and then continued on for a number of months afterwards. Do you know what, you know, what caused that?
Sacroiliitis, just in pure definition, is basically an inflammation of where the sacrum meets the ilium in your back region. And that can happen for many reasons. Sometimes it could be arthritic. Sometimes it could be viral. Sometimes it could be hormonal. And clearly, when you're pregnant in your third trimester, there are severe hormonal changes that are taking place. The other thing that can happen is, and I'm not sure this, if this was your case, but sometimes patients during pregnancy can develop something called transient osteoporosis, where bone, for unknown reason, becomes weaker, markedly painful, and weight-bearing becomes extremely difficult, and that mm-hmm. gradually resolves as well. And basically, transient osteoporosis means that the bone in that region became thinner, and it becomes more prone to micro or stress fracture-type injury, and it's very painful. So there are...
Does that end up being any kind of a permanent problem down the road if you have a weaker...
Typically, no. Typically, what we see is that if you image those patients at the time that they're having their symptoms and then re-image them, say, a year, year and a half later, they've reconstituted their bone. And we don't fully understand why it happens, but it seems to be self-limited. And we don't, as far as long-term, we don't know of any increased risk of, say, arthritic or fracture risks in that joint.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen that before in your practice?
I have seen it. I've seen it. I've actually seen it in, interestingly enough, currently I'm treating a male with it. It's a little less common in males, but it can happen as well. And sometimes it can happen from, you know, for males it can happen because their testosterone levels can be inappropriate.
Okay. Well, the doctor thought maybe it had something to do with relaxin, which apparently you, I don't know if it's a hormone or what, but it's sort of the end of pregnancy, this is sort of secreted or whatever from your body, and then it kind of made the pelvic, you know, area too relaxed or too, I don't know exactly what the word would be, and then he thought maybe that caused it.
Definitely, you know, the pelvic ligaments go through some changes during the delivery process, so it's very possible.
Okay, and would it be likely to happen again with the second pregnancy, or is that just hard to say?
Hard to say. I would think that if you've had it once, it's very possible it could happen again
during
that term of pregnancy.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And to another caller, and this is someone in Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to ask about a knee problem.
Sure.
I fell several years ago, and my meniscus separated in one knee.
Right.
And that was painful because it was, as it were, flopping around in there. So the doctor took most of it out, and the doctor, a different doctor, now says when I'm ready, he's ready to do knee surgery, partial or complete, and I'm struggling with when to do that and why no other replacement can be made for that item.
Sure. How old are you, sir?
I'm 78.
Okay. now, meniscus tears are unfortunately very common, and the meniscus is a shock absorber as well.
Right.
In the knee. It decreases some of the pressure points and can sometimes, if it's torn and not working well anymore or taken out, it can actually cause arthritis to progress quickly. And depending on...
I don't have that problem. I do take cortisone two or three times a year,
mm-hmm.
but I can't understand from my doctor why a substitute item can't be put in like a synthetic one.
Well, as far as meniscus, if you're thinking about a meniscus replacement,
yes.
There are meniscus transplants done. They're typically done from cadaver tissue. And they're usually done in knees that have essentially meniscus problems only, and the rest of the knee looks to be in good shape. So that means the cartilage on the end of the thigh bone and the shin bone is in good shape. If it is in good shape, then that's a consideration. I can tell you that the majority of people around the country who get meniscus replacements are in their teens or 20s. And that's because we're concerned about patients as they get in their 50s, 60s, and 70s having underlying cartilage problems on their thigh bone and shin bone that will not be improved despite a meniscus replacement. Now, the need for knee replacement depends on many factors. I tell patients that in addition to knee replacement, options for treatment include not only just cortisone, but lubricant injections. And if those don't work and the cortisone is short-lived, and then depending on what your x-rays show or possibly an MRI, then discussing the need for whether it be a partial knee or a full knee replacement would be considered. The upside of a knee replacement is it's been, and we touched on this earlier in our conversation, knee replacements are incredibly successful procedures in the right patient. The downside is it's obviously a major surgery with associated risks, so it's not right for everybody.
Well, I've had good luck so far, but my ability to walk is decreasing gradually, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to decide how I should know when it is appropriate to do this surgery and whether I should elect the partial or the full replacement option. My doctor simply says that he'll look at the time, and I'm unhappy about having to try to decide that for myself.
Sure. You know, sometimes hearing the opinion of other doctors is helpful. They may have a better connection with you on not only a examination perspective or recommendation, but you may connect with them more emotionally.
Well, can you suggest anything I should be conscious of in terms of talking with my doctor about this?
I think one of the thing that's been borne out in studies is asking your doctor how many knee replacements they do. you know, anyone...
Well, this one does a lot.
Okay. And then I would speak to, you know, speak to some patients in his practice in your same situation as far as age and associated medical problems and see how they've done.
Okay. Well, apparently I'm all right except for the absence of the meniscus.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether to go with the partial, the full. I know some people who've had problems with the full replacement. And I simply seem to be in a gray area between, and I just don't know what to do.
I think those are situations where just seeking a second opinion is helpful because it can help answer more questions, because it's difficult to say to you if you need a half or a full knee replacement unless I was able to see x-rays or an MRI of your knee.
But he told me originally that the partial would work, but that he said there's no such thing as a synthetic or meniscus replacement. But I found that to be incorrect when I checked further.
There is a meniscus replacement, but typically it's not done in anyone over the age of about 30, 40 years.
Okay. Because it's a blood-carrying tissue, or?
Well, there is some hope for revascularization or the blood growing into the tissue, but there's also a concern that we know just from looking at patients and studying them, as people get into their 60s and 70s, it's very unlikely that they only have an isolated meniscus problem. So even though they may be saying to you that you only have a meniscus problem, I'd be very surprised if I looked at your x-ray and MRI and only saw a meniscus problem.
I see. Well, thank you for the information.
All right, thank you. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Joseph Aboud. He is a clinical assistant professor of orthopedic surgery at University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine and is the co-author of the book No More Joint Pain, and it's published by the Yale University Press. And folks who are listening, you have questions, you can give us a call, and a doctor will do his best to help you out. 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. And I think that we do indeed have some more callers here. We'll go next to someone in Urbana, and I think this would be line number 3. Hello? there a caller there? Well, I'm not sure if by some chance I have maybe I goofed that caller up. If you were disconnected, I'm sorry. That may have been my fault. You could certainly call back, and we'll get you on here. We'll go next to somebody on line one. This is somebody calling on a cell phone. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
The doctor could comment on shoulder replacement as a resolution of osteoarthritis in a shoulder, and how sophisticated shoulder surgery is these days as compared to knee and hip and those other surgeries. I'll hang up and listen.
Sure.
All right.
shoulder surgery, as far as replacement, has made great strides, and we are on par with shoulder replacement as far as success in decreasing pain and improving function. We're on par with hip and knee replacement. Now, clearly, since hip and knee are weight-bearing, true weight-bearing joints, they tend to wear out more often, and patients tend to have more need for hip and knee replacement, and you'll tend to find more people that you've talked to that have had the hip and knee replacement. In volume, we're talking about anywhere from 400,000 to 500,000 joint replacements in the lower extremity compared to about 30,000 to 40,000 in the upper extremity or shoulder. As far as people focused in that area, there are quite a few places around the country now that do this with a very high volume or a high number of procedures are done, shoulder replacements specifically. I personally myself do shoulder replacement, and I find that the patients who have arthritis like you describe do very well. I just finished actually office hours for my morning before this interview, and five of my patients that came in are within the 4 to 6 month period of time after shoulder replacement are doing exceedingly well, very happy with the level of function, and two of them are waiting until they can get their left shoulder done as compared to they've already had their contralateral shoulder done. So it is a very successful procedure. I would advise you to see somebody who focuses their practice on the shoulder, does a fairly high volume of this, as each joint has its own nuances.
All right. I hope that helps. Just real quick, I want to ask you to talk a little bit about glucosamine and chondroitin. These are over-the-counter supplements that some people believe can be useful in repairing and restoring the cartilage that cushions the joints where they come together. And I guess that ultimately that would be something you'd really like to be able to do. This material does wear out, and if you could restore it, replace it, encourage regrowth, you'd think that would be a good thing. Is there good clinical evidence to show that, in fact, these things do have that kind of effect?
The short answer is no. I think the long answer is it still has to be kind of borne out in further long-term studies. You know, overall, when you look at there was a New England Journal of Medicine study. And basically what they showed is that it did not reduce pain effectively for osteoarthritis of the knee. And I tell my patients that come in and inquire about it that there are several factors to consider. If you want to try it, there is no major downsides. It does have glucose in it. Therefore, if you're a diabetic, you have to be careful as it can raise your blood sugars and you not know about it. Two is it does have a cost associated with it. If it doesn't hurt your pocketbook and you want to try it and see how it does, that's fine. There are some suggestions that it works somewhat like an anti-inflammatory, much like a Tylenol would. And I think that trying it, as long as you understand those things, is not a major issue. The other thing is this is a supplement. Supplements are not FDA approved. Therefore, they're not as stringently evaluated by the FDA to make sure what's placed into it and what kind of side effects it may have.
Is there anything else that's around or even on the horizon that would perform that same function that where you would think that at some point that might be useful, that you could give people a pill or you could administer it in whatever kind of way that it would actually contribute to rebuilding of that cartilage?
It's a great question. Right now, I think... that would be more in the realm of what we call gene therapy, being able to take a pill that targets a portion of your body. It can recognize cartilage damage and somehow turn on a gene to recreate a limited amount of cartilage in that area. That, I think, is something that is still well beyond the next 10 to 15 years.
All right. And we have a number of other callers here, other folks with questions. We'll just keep on going here. And the next that we'll talk to, someone in Chicago, line number 4, the toll-free line.
Yeah, this is a general question about nutrition. It seems like we hear about the oceans becoming acidic, and we hear about the coral reefs dissolving and shellfish and all that suddenly losing their crust of shell due to the acidity of the oceans. Similarly, in our body, when we eat foods that are acidic, are we causing a problem with our bones, you know, some phosphorus and acidity in the types of food we eat? Does that have an effect on our bones?
Definitely, if we have a diet that leads to what we call malabsorption, or inability for your body to absorb calcium and vitamin D properly, it can result in the development of osteoporosis or thinning of the bone. Now, clearly, as we go to a more processed food diet with more preservatives and less natural nutrients and freshness, clearly the level of vitamins and nutrients in those foods have decreased. And as our population gets older into their 70s, 80s, and 90s, and as that portion of the population starts to become a bigger part of the U.S. population, we do worry that thinning of the bone or osteoporosis is going to become more of an epidemic.
And what type of calcium or type of food would you suggest in terms of calcium maintenance is suggested or recommended?
One quick thing that you can consider is green leafy vegetables are high in calcium. If you're going to consider a calcium, also yogurts, cheeses, sardines, figs, broccoli.
Let me ask you another general question. A friend who's not here has a condition of scoliosis, causing the body misalignment, and therefore pain and tenderness in the joints and the muscles and ligaments. And the doctor at that time just merely recommended Celebrex. Do you have a view, considering the side effects attributed to Celebrex, but do you think it's still a warranted thing for relief, or do you think something else like what do we think of could be beneficial?
Well, as far as anti-inflammatories on the market, Celebrex is one of those medicines that we call COX-2 inhibitors, and I think you're referring to the recall of the drug Vioxx and Bextra, which were in the same class, and there was felt to be some increased cardiac events as well as allergic reactions to these drugs. Now, Celebrex was never found to have the same problems. It is safer on the GI system, and in the right patient, it is still used and can be used, and I do have patients on it. Myself, just from personal bias, I find that the traditional non-steroidals such as Advil, Motrin, seem to work better in my own body, and I tend to prescribe those more commonly.
All right. Hope, again, that gets at the question of the caller. We have just about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Joseph Aboud. He is clinical assistant professor of orthopedic surgery at University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine and is the co-author of the book No More Joint Pain. So that would be one resource. It's published by the Yale University Press. If you have various kinds of joint issues or you just want to learn more about joint pain causes and treatment, you can look at the book. And we'll continue to take calls here, do as many as we can in the time that remains. 3339455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. Our next caller is on our line number 2. Hello.
Yes, hi. I have a question for you pertaining to my elderly mom. She's 82 years old, and she's healthy except for she's has very hard time walking because of her hip joint problems. Is there such a thing as making a decision that pertains to her age and doing it versus not doing it?
We commonly commonly talk in medicine about physiologic and chronologic age. And some patients are 82, but they look like they're 65, and some patients are 65 and look like they're 95. And I think that if someone is in a state where they're very functional, both mentally and physically, they're just held back by the mechanical process of their joints, then certain interventions can be considered in those patients, even if they're in their 80s. There's many studies to show good outcomes in that patient population, as long as you look into that patient carefully and understand what kind of other associated medical problems they have. Is that what you were asking?
Yes. If you know, we notice that she slowly is getting less and less mobile. If we're left on, if we don't do anything, can that lead to her totally becoming immobile?
Sure. I mean, you know, one thing that we take for granted is every day, typically, barring an illness, we're mobile. And when we become immobile, our bone density decreases, our muscle mass decreases, we become weaker, it affects other organs in our body, and it causes us to have other medical problems. So mobility is very important. It's very important as we get older, and preserving it is very important. So it's a catch-22. You want her to avoid surgery to avoid risk, but you also don't want her to become so immobile that she becomes more and more medically debilitated.
Okay, one last question. If she needs both hips replaced, what's the time schedule for each replacement?
Well, they're in general they're staged, and usually they're staged at least 6 weeks apart. There are several centers around the country that will do them at the same time. These are centers that do a high volume. They're very efficient, and they do the surgery each side in half an hour. Now, those aren't prevalent everywhere, and that would be something to consider as well.
Okay, thank you.
All right, very good. Thank you. And we'll continue on another caller here, line number 3, I think, in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm the person with the meniscus problem. I had another question, please.
Mm-hmm.
If I don't elect to do the knee surgery and just stay on the infrequent cortisone, is that damaging my body, especially my liver or something else in any way?
The cortisone definitely has side effects. It will first it will weaken the soft tissues in that area where they're getting injected. So your knee, the cartilage in the knee, the muscles and tendons in that area. It also has systemic or full body effect and can oftentimes cause you to, if you get it repeatedly, to start to develop signs of diabetes.
Okay, thank you.
All right. And again, we'll go to another caller here. I think line number 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, when I was growing up, we were told not to crack our fingers, I guess, because we get joint problems. And so I was wondering if that's in fact true. And my immediate question is, when I do various exercises, I hear a cracking. So is that a bad thing if you're doing things that have constant cracking when you're doing them?
It's a very good question. And cracking your knuckles is not detrimental to your joint. Basically, it's you're taking a joint and causing fluid, a small amount of fluid in there, to pop, and it creates a noise. Now, that being said, it's not something that I would advocate doing regularly. As far as popping in your knee, I tell patients all the time that if you have a pop and it's painless, then it's a benign problem. If it's a pop and it's painful, then it could be that they have some irregular surface in there that's rubbing, and when it rubs that way, it causes a pop and pain. Now, if you're, you know, exercising and it periodically pops, what I tell patients is, you know, when you're born, you have no wrinkles on your skin. As you age, you develop wrinkles on your skin. Same thing happens inside. You develop some wrinkles with the tissue inside as well. So some painless popping is basically, in my opinion, benign wrinkles inside.
Okay, and go next to somebody in Indiana, our line 4. Hello.
Yes. My question is, I've had several meniscus operations to clean cartilage up, and the doctor has suggested a series of three shots of Sinovac or something in that area. What's your impression on the results of those?
How old are you?
How old am I?
Yes.
60.
Okay. These lubricants, are they're called viscosupplements, are synthetic products that are injected in a series of three injections into the joint, and they're FDA approved only for the knee at this point. And they're thought to work in an anti-inflammatory way, decreasing inflammation in a joint, as well as increasing the amount of lubrication in a joint to hopefully decrease the pressures or irregularity between two surfaces in your knee. Now, there are some studies to show benefit in patients who have isolated problems that are very limited or focal in the knee. So if you have a limited area that's abnormal, the rest of your knee looks fairly normal or pristine, and this is the next step since you've had, sounds like, arthroscopic knee surgery, then trying it, in my opinion, is a reasonable intervention. Does it work regularly? I wouldn't say it works regularly, but a series of three injections is more benign than further surgical intervention.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. We're coming down to the point here where we have maybe about three, four minutes left, and we have answered some specific questions for people, or you have. Hopefully, we've helped them out a little bit. We've done some general discussion, and there's a lot more. And again,
sure.
I want to say to people, you know, you can go out and take a look at the book, and it has specific sections about particular joint issues, knees, elbows, shoulders, hips, the back, and so forth, talking about what can go wrong and what can you do. I'm just before we find ourselves out of time, I just wanted to make sure that there was, or see if there was anything else in the way of general kind of information that you'd like or advice you'd like to give to people.
I think that like everyone else, I see the infomercials at night and the miracle cures. And I know patients are really afflicted by severe joint pain in many instances. And unfortunately, some of these people are preying on that sort of disparity. I think be careful of anyone who promises you a miracle. While we've made great advances in medicine, still reasonable expectations for reasonable problems. The book that we did write is a fairly straightforward, comprehensive patient-friendly book that's designed to touch in some depth on the majority of joint problems and also give you links to good resources. It's also the reason we really took upon writing this book is it's really the book is written by myself, an orthopedic surgeon, and my wife is a surgeon as well, and she's written some books as well, and so we work together on making it very user-friendly and patient-friendly and very accurate, because some of these books on the market that are written are written by people who really do not practice day-to-day orthopedic surgery and more so are really in other specialties.
All right. We want to get at least one more caller in here. We'll go to Champagne line number one. Hello.
Hello. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling about pain patches. I have a problem with my shoulder, and the doctor gave me a box of pain, a great big pad that you put on for so many hours. And then when I had trouble with my knee, they said put some of that on my knee. Is that hurting any part of my body?
Is it a lidoderm patch?
Yes.
Yes, lidoderm patch is basically a topical form of Novocaine that you get from the dentist for a dental procedure.
Uh-huh.
It helps numb the area. It's relatively safe. Obviously, an adhesive or something on your skin constantly can sometimes cause skin problems. I have used them in patients. I seem to notice a moderate response from patients. Depending on the severity of your problem and your other health issues, long-term, I don't think it's a great solution for you. Short-term, it may be helpful.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well, that maybe we can at least finish up here talking a little bit more about how you would suggest that people should approach dealing with pain. There are over-the-counter products that are available. There are things that are only available by prescription.
Right.
How do you think about that?
Our recommendation is that you start with the most benign things, which if something hurts, rest it, ice it, and elevate it. And if time or Mother Nature doesn't take care of it, then instituting the use of Tylenol, probably our most benign anti-inflammatory drug that can be used, is the first step. Then considering some of your non-steroidal anti-inflammatories would be the next step. And those are, again, over-the-counter, available. Obviously, if you're going to take them, particularly in any duration greater than 7 to 10 days, then seeing your primary about that to make sure that it doesn't cause you any problems with your stomach or your kidneys, as they can cause those problems. As pain becomes more significant, then consideration of either the role of injections, whether they be cortisone or Novocaine, or the role of narcotic pain medication. Obviously, we try to avoid narcotic pain medication as much as we can, as it does have significant side effects as well as dependency. So those are that's the way I sort of think about the pharmaceutical use of medications in my practice.
Yeah, someone called in and just wanted us to know, as a point of information for people here in our area, that one of our Ys, the McKinley Y here, offers arthritis exercise programs that take place in a pool, in a heated pool, so that would be, and I'm assuming here that the idea is it's a low impact form of exercise.
Water therapy is wonderful. Yeah. I highly recommend it to patients with arthritis. It lets them maintain joint mobility without really stressing the joints any more than they already are, and helps them avoid the progression of more severe arthritis.
All right. Well, if you'd like to read more about joint pain, what causes it, and how it's treated, you might want to take a look at the book we mentioned here a couple times, co-authored by our guest, Dr. Joseph Aboud. The title is No More Joint Pain. It's published by the Yale University Press. Dr. Aboud is Clinical Assistant Professor of Orthopedic Surgery at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Dr. Aboud, thanks very much.
My pleasure.